Welcome to Inclusion Unlocked, where we explore the changing equity, diversity and inclusion landscape, bringing you fresh perspectives, lived experiences, practical tips and next practice. I'm Sasha Scott and the founder and CEO of The Inclusive Group, and we're an equity, diversity and inclusion consultancy in the business of behaviour. Alongside our guests, we'll be exploring challenging topics and focusing on action, considering the practical steps each of us can take, whether we're leaders, HR practitioners or colleagues, to unlock inclusion in our workspace. Today, I'm joined by Lewis Raymond Taylor, founder of Globing Coaching Phenomena, The Coaching Masters. Lewis has been listed among the top 10 coaches in the world by Yahoo Finance and featured most recently in a Netflix documentary called The Psychopathic Life Coach. A powerful and in parts pretty difficult watch, tracking how childhood trauma and abuse led to a life of crime and self-sabotage. Having been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, emotionally unstable personality disorder, and bipolar disorder, the documentary explores the very uncomfortable question of whether Lewis has managed to turn his life around after a deeply troubled start, or whether his success is simply rooted in manipulation. I'm adding a bit of a trigger warning here. We're going to be unpacking some difficult topics, including childhood abuse, addiction, and suicide. This is a candid and open discussion, highlighting the impact of early trauma. But there's also a great deal of inspiration here, particularly around the importance of prioritising men's mental health and the immense value of coaching. If you've watched the documentary, I'd urge you to put any opinions to the side and dive into the discussion. I loved that programme on Netflix. It blew me away. And I thought about it. Why did I want to watch it in the first place? And I personally, I've got a bit of a background in psychology. I was like, I'm really interested in human beings and also very interested in coaching, because that's a sort of a little bit of what we do at Inclusive Group, not a massive amount. It's a small part of our business. But so I thought, OK, what a provocative title for a show as well. I mean, you know, incredible. So that is why I wanted to talk to you, because I was like, this guy's got the most incredible story. And Lewis, I'm aware that, you know, maybe people who listen to the podcast that we put out on our channel, Inclusive Unlocked, some of them won't have seen it or, you know, won't go there. And it would be, I would love to, you know, hear a bit more about your story and about why you're sitting in this chair in London, I'm assuming, probably around Canary Wharf, but as an educated guest.
Exactly. In Canary Wharf, you're exactly right. Yeah.
Absolutely. But you know what? Your life has been extraordinary, and I think still probably is completely extraordinary, but it may be in a more controlled, measured way. I don't know. But can you tell us a little bit more about the backstory and about the history?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how deep you want to go and how many sort of
very deep,
short, medium, long version. Obviously, the long version, I mean, actually, the long version is in the book that I'm writing at the moment. I've got a book deal with Penguin Random House, which is going to be coming out towards the end of next year. So that's going to be
brilliant,
as detailed as it gets. The documentary is a pretty good hour and a half version. But even that, really, it's kind of difficult for me to really speak everything, because it's obviously contributors and other people talking. So there's so much to my life that it is difficult to share it in short form, but I will try and give you a bit of a summary for people that haven't heard of me at all or haven't watched the documentary. So what we're referring to is the Netflix documentary that came out a couple of weeks ago called The Psychopath Life Coach, and it did reach the top 10 charts, I'm proud to say, for 2 days, which is incredible. Had a mixture of responses, some very, very positive, saying, you know, it's life-changing, they've never been so inspired before, they've finally found someone they can relate and connect to, and some messages that, you know, would blow you away if you saw them. Also equally some negativity, as you would imagine, and obviously with the controversy of the headline, you know, the media jumps on it and tries to create all sorts of issues, and there was, you know, there was a amount of controversy in the documentary anyway that I was aware of, and when you knew it was going to be in there, and that was because, you know, I wanted it to be entertaining and interesting, and there are different people's perceptions of what we're doing, and I'm happy for that to have that neutral kind of balance. So I've been called a cult leader, I've been called a manipulator, I've been called probably many other things that I'm not aware of as well. But I've also been called someone who's, you know, changed a lot of people's lives and is a good guy and has a bit of a difficult background. So the documentary explores the theme of me formally being diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder when I was 18, and whether or not I ever had that whether or not that was, well, actually coming on to something completely separately since then, I've had quite a few people message me saying they think that I'm autistic. It's a complete plot twist.
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. On the spectrum anyway, not obviously fully, but because there's lots of these labels and there's lots of different symptoms that can cross over or be misdiagnosed. And I've actually been diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder, bipolar type 2, and also emotionally unstable personality disorder, which is borderline. So those are the three that I've been diagnosed
right.
with over the years.
Yeah.
And then, the antisocial personality disorder is the most intriguing one because it's the clinical term that's given to psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
Psychopaths are more on the spectrum of the people that, you know, don't have any guilt or remorse and typically get some sort of thrill out of hurting people and, you know, typically tend to be violent, and they're the ones that you would hear of as the psychopaths that go out and commit murders and things like that. But there are also a marginalized part of society of people with personality disorders or even psychopaths, fully blown psychopaths with no emotion whatsoever, that are politicians or business leaders or maybe not, maybe just that's the way they are, but they have to wear a mask, have to cover up who they are for fear of judgment because of the stereotype and the stigmatization of what that label represents in people's minds. You know, if you've ever learned about NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, words have a lot of meaning to people. And the moment you say psychopath, it scares people and it worries people. So no one's going to come out and admit those things. And also they do come with a lot of narcissistic and other negative traits that people don't want to admit to, but 9 times out of 10 most people display that in some form or another at some point in their life, and people don't want to talk about their flaws, but I think that the more we, you know, can be vulnerable and can be honest and can have the awareness around who we are, there are more opportunity we have for growth. So that's why I was happy to expose all of that part of me to inspire other people to inwardly reflect on themselves and sort of see whether or not maybe there's a part of them that they're denying or not bringing their awareness to, or could learn more about themselves. So that's the kind of psychopathy side. But of course, there's the argument of, was that nature versus nurture?
Yeah.
Have I still got this personality disorder? Have I channeled it into a different area? Or am I this out and out psychopath that is just, you know, still being this cunning, baffling, manipulative con man out to take people's money and just putting on a smile rather than a frown? No one really knows the answer, and I couldn't even give you the straight one, to be honest, because you know,
honest.
Who knows, it could be a bit of a mixture.
Because
I didn't give myself that label, I didn't give myself that diagnosis, I don't know anyone other than myself. I can't really compare myself to other people, really, only sort of what they show me. But I know that I'm different. But I don't necessarily know whether or not that's due to being a psychopath or not, or whether it's a product of trauma or a product of my upbringing or a product of the education that my parents gave me or things they said. Or, you know, so there's so many questions that are unanswered, and psychology is such a nuanced subject that, like my wife said in the documentary, it's not a perfect science, and it's very, very difficult to be able to say one way or the other, and so I can't. So that's the kind of psychopath stuff. So I've spoke a lot there, so I'll give you an opportunity to speak, and then I guess we can dive into the actual story of what sort of led me down that path.
Sure. So What I think is fascinating is, the question is, does there have to be one reason? Because I don't think there is ever is one reason in life. There are maybe multiple factors that have resulted in you getting those diagnoses that will be a combination of things rather than just one thing. And also, I just wanted to explore this thing about labels. I wrote some notes before I came, and something that struck me quite significantly when watching the Netflix documentary was, when you were a kid, there appeared to be quite an inspiring teacher or teaching assistant, a woman, and she said, "I remember Lewis coming to me, and I said," she said to you, "something like, you're a good boy," and you turned around and said, "No, I'm bad. I am bad." I'm not sure if I've remembered it correctly,
That's correct, man.
but Lewis, what I was thinking was, like, you labels. We're talking about labels here, right? Labels are really important in your life, in so much that if that is to be really believed, which I'm sure it was, you believed fundamentally you were bad, no good, and then were playing up to that and living that life through because you'd believe that. And now I look at you running an uber successful coaching business. You've scaled that hugely from what I can see. And you've turned it completely around, but I think by saying to people, it's that whole I think therefore I am. You can help people through your coaching and others that coach through that formula, believe in themselves. Because I it seems to me like you tore up a label about yourself when you got to that absolute rock bottom and you were going through all the detox and stuff. I'm not sure if I've got the timing right, but and then you started to believe something different. Is that
Absolutely.
right?
Absolutely. And I think it's common for everybody, whether or not it's that label or something else. I happen to have some clinical labels, but I'd given myself some as well. And it comes down to the identity, doesn't it? The labels forms the identity of who you are, and who you are and how you sit in the world is going to dictate your behavior, which is going to dictate your actions, which is going to dictate your life and ultimately your destiny. So it all has this knock-on effect. And the question is, where does it come from? And it comes from, you mentioned it, beliefs. It's information that's fed to us. I think it's before the age of seven, we're sponges. We're just absorbing information. We're using it to form meaning of how the world works and who we are. And if that information isn't positive or constructive, or it's being interpreted in the wrong way, then you start to form beliefs about yourself in loads of different ways. Some people might be watching this, maybe thinking they're not good enough, or they're not smart enough, or they're not pretty enough, or who knows what that could look like for somebody. And then usually, once those beliefs are formed, we start to only absorb beliefs that form in line with the same kind of belief. So it's called distortion. So we start to distort information to align with our belief system. So the moment it happens and you've created this kind of, okay, well, I'm bad, then you start to notice other information that confirms you're bad, and then that dictates your behavior, which makes you react badly, which then creates more, information to form more beliefs that you're bad, and then you create this cycle, which really, really is hard to get out of a lot of the time. So you're absolutely right. I formed an identity that I was bad, unlovable, and that took me down a very damaging pathway, and I was able to flip the script. And it was through the awareness around that wasn't me, that was simply some things that I'd heard, some information from other people, and that it could be changed. I didn't have the awareness that it could be changed. I thought you were who you were. I didn't understand that it was a belief system that I'd created. I didn't even knew that it came from my dad, which it did. It did come from my dad. I didn't know that. I don't think, I don't think anyone's really cognitively aware of where their beliefs come from, because they're only a subconscious mind. It's only through the power of coaching that we actually can drag those sorts of bits of information from the subconscious into the conscious and start to become aware of it. And then when we're aware of it, we can make the decision to choose whether or not it's serving us and move it, out of our life, or change it in some way to help improve the quality of our life. But this was all happening on autopilot, and I didn't know any other way, and that's why I got myself into a lot of shit, I think.
Absolutely. What I find so really staggering is how, from a lot of shit and a lot of carnage, you managed to flip that script. Can you tell me more about how long that flipping took place? I mean, did you flip and then sometimes go back? And like, so life is rarely a straight path. And I'm like,
Well,
how
I
did,
would
because
say,
that is everything, isn't it? That is everything.
I mean, just to give people a bit of context so I can summarize this, I mean, I was naughty from a young age, and then I got nearly expelled from primary school. I was expelled from school. I was had an asthma at 14. I was in a young offenders institution at 18. I was taking drink and drugs. I was a drug addict. I was a drug dealer. I was violent. Had crimes for multiple crimes for GBH, which were serious violent crimes. So this is just to give people a perspective of, and my life evolved around criminality. And it was destructive and abusive, and I was just a horrible person, really. It wasn't just naughty, bad behavior. I was also just vile in myself because I felt bad. On the
Right.
inside, if you feel bad and you know you're bad, then that's exactly the character that I was going to play. That was the identity that I had. So that really did. So that gives people context of where I was in terms of how I changed it. I was lucky and unlucky in the sense where well, from as long back as I can remember, I've been very impulsive and addictive, and I've been addicted to drink, drugs, gambling, sex, alcohol, cigarettes, and even now work, and whatever thing that I can get something from, I will grab it, and I find it very difficult to let go of it. If something gives me a fix, I want, I always want more. So I was fortunate enough where I went to prison for the third time. Had a realization that I was the problem. To try and summarize things, obviously there's a lot of context to it, but I realized that I was the problem, and that I could change. And I made a very firm, hard, cold decision that I was going to change myself. And I think that's important because a lot of people don't make that solid commitment. They just, I'm going to make a few bits of changes here, there, and might see how it goes. But if you can really make that rock solid promise to yourself, it's hard to go back on. So I made that was the first thing I did, is I made a decision, the most powerful thing someone can do. And then luckily this addictive personality part of me got obsessed with the idea of changing myself and wanting to do everything. So I just immersed myself in everything. I was like, right, well, I'll read and I'll tidy up and I'll enroll in the maths and English, and oh, there's a rehab program, and oh, I'm going to go to the church, and I'm going to go to AA meetings, and I just become obsessed with it. So I just absorbed what someone would doing changing their life over a 10-year period in like a 1 month period, because it's this new shiny thing for me, and it's given me a little something, so I want more. And to be honest, that roller coaster never really stopped up until now. I've just constantly been taking one step in front of the next. So the journey has taken me 8 years, but to be honest, I was, the most growth came over the first few years. Obviously, in terms of the status and the followers and the money and all those sorts of things, I guess, are more so now. But the growth in myself happened pretty immediately, I'd say within the first year, because I went into a 6 months fully intensive rehabilitation treatment center, and that was so immersive. And I talked about my problems for the first time in my life, and they made me cry. They didn't make me cry, but they facilitated me to cry, and all sorts of things. And I did, again, 10 years worth of therapy in 6 months, because I was at a position where it was, I was going to die if I didn't, because the abuse I was putting myself through. I tried to commit suicide. I had so many injuries due to the fight, and I was close, very close, a number of times. So this was serious. So that's why, intervention like rehab is a luxury that most people don't have the advantage of, because it's only when things get really bad that you're ever going to, make the decision to go to rehab for 6 months. And I didn't want to go, but I needed to. And it was immersive. So I was able to get really good support and care. And I just walked out of the place with my head feeling clear, understanding myself, weight better, feeling supported. And then just really got into personal development, and just always look for that next thing that I could learn, and the next thing I could take advantage of, whether it was AA meetings or it was books or podcasts or mentors or coaches or courses. And I went back to college and uni and just kept on just taking the steps, but as fast as I could and as quickly as I could. And there was obviously natural talent that was always there that I was just suppressing and not using. So
yeah,
and we all have it as well. You know, the guy that has, sorry, not the guy, that's the worst thing to say, that wasn't meant, but the person that has the cure for cancer could be lying on the sofa right now watching Netflix, you know,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
not knowing that they have that ability or that information inside them. So I think that I was able to, cliche as it sounds, unlock my potential. You know, that's what we're all aiming to do, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the potential was there, but I needed to access it. And there was a lot of trauma in the way. There was a lot of confusion in the way. And there was layers to it. And once I'd sort of got that out of the way, I was then able to then sort of crack the code of my mind and start using it because I'd never used it. You know, I'd felt stupid my whole life.
Amazing.
To the point where I was accessing no parts of my brain because I didn't want to, I was scared to. So it wasn't used. But the moment it started using it, it, you know, it's like a muscle, isn't it? It was working. It was getting stronger. It was getting smarter. And then that with the surge of motivation that came from seeing the results and, you know, being so surprised at, with mainly the belief in myself that I could change because I didn't think I could. But once I was seeing the results and I was having the belief in myself, wow, this is possible. I was like, well, what else can I do? And I've just kept on taking one step in front of the next. And it's just gone by in a flash. And
8 years later. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's incredible. It's incredible. And when you were doing that initial work of growth on yourself, did you then, through that sort of self-exploration, understanding ourselves and understanding the difference between what we think and, you know, how we operate and slowing down and mindfulness and things like that, did you then think, actually, one, I understand who I am and where I'm going, but two, I want to take some of this stuff I've learned and almost commoditize it, take it to people.
Yeah, take it
to people.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, it wasn't necessarily I know who I am. It was more I know I'm not, which is the biggest problem.
Okay. Yeah.
I felt I was bad and unlovable, and I was actually, maybe I'm not. And actually, I can see where this comes from now. And this isn't my shit. This is someone else's. It's my dad's. This isn't helpful. I've been beating myself up my whole life. You know, is that really going to, do I want to keep on holding on to that or do I want to try something new? So that was the first thing. And I'm still sort of finding myself, as it were, now.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say I'm quite there with that. But in terms of commoditizing it, it wasn't my first goal. Interestingly, I didn't have, I really didn't think about making money from it initially. So I did drug and alcohol meetings. And first of all, I was very shocked at Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, how effective they are. For myself personally, because I was in this community, I could share openly, I could learn, I could be a part of something. I was staying clean and sober. I was learning so much. And I was just thinking, wow, this is, and then, but I was also seeing other people's results, you know, people that have been on heroin for 20 years who are clean and now they've got, you know, starting a business. And you just see amazing transformations and you just think, wow, this is, you know, almost miraculous how this is happening. And but what actually is the process of these meetings? And I just sat there and thought, it's just a chat in a room, with people that give a shit. And I just thought this needs to be available for people that haven't got to rock bottom. And I think, like I was said earlier, I kind of had the luxury of hitting rock bottom so that I could go to rehab and things like that. So I had to work on myself. Most people let it get really bad before they do the work. You know, they're okay with living in a normal sort of existence without unlocking their potential or thriving because it's comfortable and there's no particular need to do anything about it. But I looked at this model of AA and NA and I just thought, this needs to be available to people that aren't suffering necessarily, but just want to improve an area of their life or maybe have a goal. So I started to ask people if they'd be interested, and nobody was. So I started to help people for free. So I'd meet up with them in Costa Coffee. I would find them online, find people that were moaning and miserable. I'd meet up with them in Costa Coffee, and I'd sit down with them and I'd just help them. And then I realized that everything that I'd learned in rehab and my own journey and the AA meetings, and not just myself, but everyone else's triggers and traumas and denials and relapses and stories and beliefs, I just learned so much. And I was just helping these people and I was just getting great results for them. And it was only at that point where I thought, I did a bit of research. I thought, wow, I could actually be a life coach. I could, by the looks of it, I can be a good one here because I'm helping these people.
Yeah.
So I started becoming a life coach and I made money out of that. And it was only then when I thought, oh, let's go back to the original plan of creating that community that I wanted to do, that sort of group therapy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then I thought, but then I also had this sort of online brain. You know, my brain's always, like, my dad was in IT. He bought me a computer when I was quite young. So he didn't always do the worst things to me. He did some positive things. I'm grateful for that because he kind of programmed my mind, I think, in a, from a technological perspective quite early on.
Yeah.
Even though it only had like paint on it, I think that was the only thing it had on it.
Yeah.
It was enough for me to just
to
I
think
don't know.
Digitally. Yeah.
Yeah, to think digitally. So before COVID and before online was a massive thing, I was like, I need to create that offline AANA community for everyday people online.
Okay.
And that's how I started. And that's what's evolved into the multi-million dollar business that exists today.
Yeah, that's just phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And if we think about things like AA and NA, that's a very rigorous program with the 12 steps. And there is, you know, some people say, you know, that's quite cultish, etc. It seems to me that you've taken elements of that, talking therapy, group therapy, storytelling, sharing, no judgment. And have you taken elements of a lot of different sort of therapies that you've been on the receiving end of and put them into the coaching model?
Yeah. I mean, our coaching accreditation that we offer is a mixture of me and my business partner's lived experience, tools, techniques, models, and frameworks that have been around for decades in the 80s when coaching NLP was first getting going. Things that I'd learned on my own personal journey, things I've learned in AANA. You know, no one really owns the intellectual property of these things.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
I was like, this is what worked for me and this is what will work likely for you as well. And we didn't really think much of it when we first created it. It was a course because people wanted to learn. Because we were successful coaches. People wanted to learn what we were doing strategically in a business sense, but they also wanted to learn what we were doing with our clients, because there's two things you need to grow a successful coaching business. You need to know how to coach people well and get good results, and you need to know how to get clients. We were doing both well. So they wanted to learn how to do both. So I started teaching people the strategy of the online stuff.
Yeah.
And that was new at the time. So, you know, 8 years ago or 7 years ago when I started it, normal things like Zoom calls for coaching sessions and social media content people weren't doing it. People were just going to networking meetings and hoping for, you know, giving a business card out and hoping for the best. So I started teaching sort of that basics. To me, it was basic strategy, not so basic for a lot of people. But and then they started saying, well, I want to also know how to coach. So me and my business partner put together this coaching training and didn't think too much of it really. But then the response to it was, it's changed their life and they absolutely loved it. And that's what showed us that we had something special within the coaching training, because it was raw and unique and authentic and different. I think with the coaching space, it's been quite similar and generic and dated for a while. And we brought a new energy to it and the lived experience part of it as well. You know, there's certain things you can learn in books and things like that. And there's certain things that, I think it was Rich Lipkin that said you can only take someone to the depths you've been yourself. So, you know, I don't entirely believe that, because there are very powerful tools, techniques, and models and frameworks that you can use to really help somebody. But there's also an added edge that you can take somebody to where you go, I know what that feels like because I remember being there. And this is what I did to get out of it. And, you know, there's a special source there with that. And the trauma that I've been through on top of the bad things that I've done, such as, you know, walking in and found my dad dead, the suicide, the sexual abuse, you know, as well as my dad sort of calling me names and hitting me and things like that. And also my business partner was in the London terror attacks. He lost his dad to suicide. So combine our traumas and our experience and how we've been able to flip the script on that, and what we say, turn adversity into an asset, which is something people find hard to grasp, because that, you know, how could you ever be grateful for those things? You know, people will look to try and get through those things at best, but you can actually get to a place where you've learned so much through it that you've become a better person. And if you can go and help someone else with it, then they become a better people and the world becomes a better place through those experiences. And you can also monetize it as well, which is brilliant. A nice little bonus as well, which is an even bigger asset. So we talk about turning adversity into an asset, and that's a big part of what the course has allowed us to do.
And so I think it becomes very sort of accessible because of the honesty of you and your business partner, you know, really making, you know, what has happened to you viscerally affect other people if they're open to listening to that. And I think that you don't look like many coaches. And I mean that as a compliment. I think it's really good to have far more diversity in that coaching space, which is, I think, probably very predominantly white and, you know, just quite homogenous. So I think that's really, really helpful, because it sort of sends a message just through both of you to people that anything is possible. Anything is possible, because you're going, look at us, look at this shit that's happened. And this is deep, deep trauma, huge, absolutely huge. And I just want to explore a bit more around turning adversity into an advantage, because an asset, right? I think that when we go through really hard stuff, it can really help build a resilience, right? Which is very important to have. I mean, you're a parent, I'm a parent. We want our kids to be resilient, because life can be utterly shit, right? I think a lot of people don't feel they are very resilient, and they worry about that. Do you find in the coaching you're working a lot on helping really bolster people's resilience through adversity or through the methods?
I would say that's more so what our coaches would end up coaching people on. I think a lot of people that are attracted to us as the coaching masters are other people that have been through shit, because that's our kind of message, right? They identify, I've also been through shit. And because the thing is, once you've been through it and you've been able to learn how to get through it, you feel compelled to share it with other people. And if someone else is in a similar position, then it's kind of your duty to kind of lead the way for them. Not everybody will, but there's a collection of people that really want to do that. So those are the people that go, right, I want to become a coach because I've been through this, and I've handled this, and I now have the mat so I can share it with other people, because some people get through it and some people don't. Some people will live with depression their whole lives, or they'll crumble, or they'll sabotage. And it takes a certain type of person to be able to go, no, and I'm going to be able to push through this. And that person would make a great coach. Now, those people can then support other people that maybe are less resilient, and they maybe have imposter syndrome or self-doubt, and they find it difficult to get through day-to-day life. And they look up to, you know, coaches that have had significant things happen to them and can put things in perspective, like you say, because they go, well, hang on a minute, you know, yeah, I feel like a bit stressed out of work, but, you know, at least I haven't been sexually abused. You know, you can start. Hang on a minute. You know, it's not as bad as it could be. There's a variety of things that can be solved or remedied, I guess. I don't know if that's solved is probably the right word, but redirected through coaching. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. It's a bit of a difficult
It does.
One. I've given some information anyway.
No. It's very, very helpful, because, you know, we work a lot in corporate workspaces around the world. And, you know, definitely the thing that we're noticing in a working environment is that people are feeling pretty lost. There's a ton of burnout. People are feeling a high amount of covering an element of who they are. About 60% of people cover an element of who they are in the workplace, according to some research I saw this week on multi dimensions, right? And I think that I think people are generally feeling that, you know, work is It's interesting because of COVID and working remotely, which has obviously happened to lots of people. There is now a real tension in the workplace when organizations are trying to get people back into the office and et cetera. And I think that's causing massive tension. And I just feel that there is enormous scope for people to have support, whether it's through coaching or different therapies or whatever. But lots of people don't do it because of the stigma associated to it and or can't afford it, etc. But I think that because the world is so sort of polarized as well at the moment, and people are feeling so generally, very under pressure, there has never actually been a more urgent time for the sorts of things that remedies, solutions, paths, frameworks to help people 100%. I just really noticed that now. I think there's so many different things. I just wrote a summary of last year and I'll send it to you, but I just feel that there is, a real urgency around this, a real urgency.
100%. Yeah, and like I said in the documentary, I mean, it's interesting because there's so many issues, but if you really look at psychiatry, coaching, mentoring, psychotherapy, counseling, it's all just talking, and it's all just bringing awareness to yourself and also connecting with other people. And I think, like you mentioned there, the fact that 60% of people have to cover up who they are, it must be exhausting to be able to have to do that. And why do they feel like they have to do that? And what comes with that? Shame, guilt, a lack or a loss of identity, or
Totally.
so there's so many knock-on effects of that. And really, the solution is just bringing the conversation to the fact that we can be open, vulnerable, honest, and acceptant of one another. And communicate to one another and facilitate that. And you'll find that symptomatically, the knock-on effect of all these other things that they're experiencing will likely start to dissolve. As we try and tackle the symptoms rather than the cause. It's like, oh, I'm feeling anxious, so I need to solve my anxiety by doing mindfulness. No, you don't. Stop covering up who you are, and then you won't feel like you. Then you won't feel that, if that is their particular core issue, for example, then you won't notice this happened and that happened and this happened and then ultimately this. So every symptom has a cause. What's the cause? How can we talk about the cause? Because for me, it was sitting down in a counseling session, one to one, and her talking, the counselor talking about my dad, and me blurting out why was he so horrible to me, and me realizing that I've been beating myself up the whole time, thinking that it was my fault for being a bad son, and that I deserved, to be treated in that way. The moment I kind of heard myself say that, it kind of clicked. I was like, shit, that's it. That's it. And it was a light bulb moment. It was a breakthrough moment. It was a release of tears. And my life's never been the same again. Now I've had many other breakthrough moments like that. But all that required was a conversation and awareness around what was actually going on, and I think that, a part of the problem is people aren't prepared to be vulnerable enough to be able to go to those places. So embracing vulnerability, I think, is a big important thing. It's probably especially amongst males, I would say, is even more so. So yeah, embracing vulnerability. And I hope that's something that my documentary can do. And I know that it will have. And I know that from the messages, it seems to have had that effect. I mean, I think there's many men that have sort of openly discussed some of those things and the effect that it's had on them. But from the response I've got, it's not my story isn't as unique as you might think it is. It's just not spoken
Interesting.
about. It's not spoken about as much as you would expect. So my story is actually very, very common, but it's unique in the sense where it's public.
Do you work a lot with younger people, going to schools and things like that?
Went to one school, interestingly,
Because
the
you would
school
be
that just
great on that circuit. You were, I mean, you probably don't have time, but it's like to hear that message around vulnerability when you're young. I mean, it goes right back to what we were saying at the front end about, the seminal stuff that happens when you're tiny
course,
can
yeah.
imprint and
Oh, yeah.
hardwire one's brain.
100%. I mean, I did go back to one school. I've been really focused on building the business. I've been doing less sort of charitable work just because I have to create money to be able to free up time to be able to help the charities in the future. But I do plan on doing more charity work like that. I've got some penciled in. But to be honest, the larger vision that I have is outside of the coaching space, and that is, I know it's big, but is to reinvent education. I want to create a different alternative education system
Wow.
because I believe that it's archaic. It's built off the Industrial Revolution. It doesn't include anything that we need to thrive in the modern day world. It teaches us algebra and photosynthesis, but doesn't teach us about ourselves and our emotions and who we are. And like we said, vulnerable, anything we've discussed today.
Communication, everything.
Yeah. Every single thing we've mentioned today, that's absolutely fundamentally key for a human to be even moderately happy, is not in the curriculum. So that needs disrupting. And I've created a similar platform and a community in coaching. I don't see why I can't expand that out to a larger demographic and a larger content type. So that's in the works.
That sounds amazing. God, I've
So
been watching
then,
that space. That does sound incredible. And what about your aspirations for acting?
I mean, that was, that's one of my things. It's not like I'm going to just jump ship. I mean, I'd like to be an actor because it was one of my first goals, when I was a child. So I want to revisit that, and also I practice what I preach. I tell people to go after their dreams, and it's one of my dreams. So I can't settle, although settling for what I've got is actually a great thing to settle for, it still would technically be settling. So I have to go after, the number one. So I'm moving in that direction as well. There's some opportunities on the cards and I'm actively pursuing that, but it's not a full pivot. It's a side thing whilst I'm still on a mission. I've still got lots of work to do. I feel like I'm just getting started.
I get that impression. I think you have a very, very, very busy brain, and it's like you say, those kind of addictions have just been channeled into passions. Can't get enough of what's next, what's next, not what's next. How have you found parenthood changing your life and your sense of your pace and your urgency, etc.?
Practically it is tough, to be honest. More than I
Hard.
thought. I've luckily got a wife, and she's very, very maternal, and she finds that very natural. My paternal bond hasn't been as intense as her maternal one has. So I would say that she's taken a more predominant role there, which is, well, I don't know what that means, but yeah, she's looking after our son a lot more whilst I work. It's not that I don't see my son, but she's doing a lot of the night feeds. And
It's a tough gig. It's a really tough gig.
yeah,
Absolutely. So, and yeah.
to balance both a business and a baby is obviously difficult. And fortunately, my wife has, I've been able to, put her in a position where she doesn't have to work. So
That's brilliant.
that's sort of the dynamics we're taking at the moment, quite the traditional kind of provider and the nurturer, so that's kind of the roles we're taking. But we just came back from a holiday from the Canary Islands, where we spent some time together with the baby
Lovely.
and with Ocean, his name. And
That's
yeah,
beautiful. Lovely.
it's this big adjustment, and it's something that I'm stepping into more and more. And I think I'll have some unique, not challenges with it, but I think that maybe my relationship as a father will probably be a slower burner than some, maybe because of this emotional disconnect that I have, whether that's from the trauma or the personality disorder or whatever. So I love my son, but I just see the way that my wife looks at him and obsesses about him, and it is different. So I think that it's I think I'll have more of an update to share about that in a year's time, maybe, because he's still only 11 weeks old.
He's
So I'm
tiny,
still,
tiny, tiny.
yeah,
Yeah,
he's just pops
congratulations.
out.
Yeah, exactly.
I still have to remind myself that I'm actually a dad sometimes.
Well, glad that we got on the call then, just to let you know. So at least you're spared the night feeds, because sleep deprivation is enough to make somebody absolutely bonkers. So,
Yeah, I mean, I actually have
hats off to your
epilepsy
lovely
as
wife.
well, because
Really? Right.
and that triggers it as well. So actually, funny
Right.
enough, I on the night, not funny enough, but when we gave birth to Ocean, because I didn't, because she went into labor at like 2 a.m. or something, I didn't sleep that night, and I actually had a seizure the day of the birth, just because of that.
Oh my
And it was also
God.
stress as well. So I've got a little nice excuse to have get my sleep.
Yeah, so I think that's quite valid, actually, Lewis, I have to
Yeah.
say. I have to say. One thing I briefly wanted to ask you, which I'm just really interested in your point of view on it. A lot of what we talked about today, I absolutely buy into with you in terms of talking about things, sharing stories, listening, helping people effectively rewire and look at the world a different way, flip their script. What role do drugs play in all this? So, because you've seen psychiatrists, you've seen, doctors, what about medication? Because when you're in AA and NA, are people, what's your view on people using medication to keep them on effectively, functioning and,
I mean, I wouldn't be
okay?
able to, I mean, I can just give you whatever comes out my mouth, but I'm not a psychiatrist, so I
No,
couldn't,
sure.
I couldn't share what. I mean, if someone needs medication because they have severe mental illnesses, then take them. For example, I've got epilepsy medication. I tried to not take it because I wanted to try and take a natural path, and I kept on having seizures, and my doctor said, "You are playing Russian roulette," and he said, "You can die if you do that. You can have cardiac arrests with you when you have seizures." So I have to have a meds for life now for that. But there are other disorders that don't require medication. There are also misdiagnoses which don't require medication. I was at one point prescribed antipsychotics. I took them for 1 week, and they gave me seizures, funny enough.
Really,
It was before I
really.
didn't realize, I didn't know I had epilepsy, so I thought it was because of the meds, so I just didn't take it, and that was that. But I shouldn't have taken them because I never needed those. So an answer to this, I couldn't give an answer on it. I would say each journey in each case is completely different, and it requires an expert opinion on it. But there are people that will change their lives and become completely medication free. There are people that will require lifelong medication, and there are people that didn't need medication in the first place. So,
So it, like
difficult one.
everyone's unique. Yeah, exactly. There is never, it's like everything we're talking about. There is never going to be one answer. But I
No.
was just curious because, I have really, really been astounded by how you've taken, so many different elements and wrapped them into the coaching in such a successful way. It's fantastic. And
Thank
yeah,
you.
it's great. It's really, really great. So I have really enjoyed, thank you for your time, Lewis. I've
You're
really
welcome.
enjoyed listening to you and profoundly grateful that you gave me your time today.
Of
It's
course,
amazing.
no worries at
Thank
all. No,
you. Really
I've enjoyed
appreciate
it.
it. Really
No problem.
appreciate
Thanks
it.
for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Well, it's my pleasure. I'm incredibly grateful that Lewis gave up his time to join us on Inclusion Unlocked for one of the most powerful discussions we've ever had on the virtual sofa. And of course, if you'd like to learn more about Inclusive Group and can help your organization drive real change, I'd love to hear from you. To find out more about our work or arrange a conversation, please click on the link on the landing page of this episode and follow through to our website.